And our preaching text today is 1 Chronicles 12:32. Of Issachar, men who had understanding of the times to know what Israel ought to do, 200 chiefs and all their kinsmen under their command. That first Sunday after Christmas, anticipating the new year, I like to preach a text, a sermon, exhorting us to consideration of a thing through the year. And today, our text will guide us. I think we're at a very important crossroads in the life of our nation and world, for that matter. And I want to exhort us to be as men of Issachar here today. So with that in mind, we have our message today tuned in from 1 Chronicles 12:32. In May of 1548, the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V gave his ultimatum to the German princes who had embraced the Protestant cause. He called it the interim, and that ultimatum was return to Mother Church or have it reimposed upon you by military force. Now, those German princes had confederated together in what was called the Schmalkaldic League, which was a military alliance to provide for their common defense against precisely this kind of threat. It was clear from the tenor of the times that the demand for reform had grown so great that the Pope and the Emperor would react to it, and soon, and not in a conciliatory manner either. All the interests of the Roman Catholic Church and the Holy Roman Empire were threatened by the Reformation. Economic interests, political interests, religious interests, the whole house of tarot cards threatened to come down, crashing on the heads of the emperor and the church. Anyone with eyes to see knew that Rome would strike back with full force. And it is acknowledged that the men of the city of Magdeburg, Germany, were in the vanguard of forming and organizing this defense of the Protestant cause. They had eyes to see. Led by the pastors of the city, they crafted a rationale for their taking political and military action against the interim of Charles V. That rationale has come down to us as the Magdeburg Confession of 1550. It is an eloquent, tightly and biblically reasoned case for resisting the magistrate. Now, this has historic precedents, a long tradition, not very well known by the contemporary church, however. The first argument of the Magdeburg Confession says the magistrate is an ordinance of God for honor to good works and a terror to evil works, citing Romans chapter 13. Therefore, when he begins to be a terror to good works and an honor to evil, there is no longer in him, because he does thus, the ordinance of God, but the ordinance of the devil. And he who resists such works does not resist the ordinance of God, but the ordinance of the devil. Unquote. Importantly, the Magdeburg Confession honors the long-held doctrine of the lesser magistrate. That is, when a greater magistrate, like a king or an emperor or a president, has forfeited his right to govern through his evil behavior, then it is the right, yea, the duty of the lesser magistrate, a prince or a state governor in our contemporary scene, to resist him, even to the point of armed resistance. And over the centuries, the Magdeburg Confession has stood the test of time in eloquently making the case for the doctrine of the lesser magistrate. Now, I've got a three-part series on our website, americastruths.org, americastruths.org, one word, on the doctrine of the lesser magistrate. And it's under the series button if you wanted to access that. Well, in October of 1550, the bishop's forces laid siege to the city of Magdeburg and invested it until November of 1551. But the men of Magdeburg, led by her pastors, had prepared their defense as well, including the hearts and the spirits of the people. Rome's efforts to reimpose Roman Catholicism in Magdeburg failed, though not without great sacrifice to the people of that city. It's a rollicking good tale if you want to read more detail about it. Now, Magdeburg led the defense league because her pastors saw the temper of the times and acted accordingly. They did not cower in fear or pretend that all they had to do was preach the gospel and leave the rest to others. They were men in the long tradition of Issachar, men who had understanding of the times, to know what Israel ought to do. Well, how does Issachar measure up then? What did they have to say? What was their tradition? Let's look to our text today. 2 points I'd like to make with you from it. Tuned in. As the men of Issachar in Israel, so the church needs men today who understand the times in which they live. From verse 32a. Now, the context for our verse is the assemblage of the faithful few from the tribes of Israel at Hebron, who turned the kingdom of Saul over to him, that is to David, according to the word of the Lord. Events had unfolded such that Israel had reached a crossroads in her history, yea, the whole of redemptive history, we could say, since a conclusion had been reached in hot pursuit of David by his king, Saul the Benjamite. And as providence would have it, it would be the Philistines and not David who would slay Saul and his sons Jonathan and Abinadab and Malchishua, slain on Mount Gilboa. Now David goes on now to take Jerusalem and be anointed king at Hebron. And here we are treated to a glimpse of loyalty and faithfulness when in the dark days of uncertainty, a few rallied to his side. A significant cohort in that number were men of Issachar. Issachar was the 9th son of Jacob, the 5th by Leah. And Issachar means man of hire, literally. But in the context here, when we look at Leah, it could be translated as well as there is recompense. Leah had recompense for the mandrakes that she gave to Rachel, ostensibly to help make her fertile. But Leah found recompense in that she became pregnant again for the 5th time with her son Issachar. Jacob's blessing of Issachar reflects his name too. That was read for us this morning. Issachar is a strong donkey, crouching between the sheepfolds. He saw that a resting place was good and that the land was pleasant, so he bowed his shoulder to bear and became a servant at forced labor. Some translate this as difficult or strenuous labor. The recompense, if you will, for difficult, strenuous labor was a good land, a pleasant land, which Issachar settled in central Israel. Issachar, as a tribe, developed a reputation for serious work and loyalty and faithfulness. In Judges, we had this read for us this morning, Judges 10, 1 through 2. One of the judges who delivered Israel in the days of the judges was of Issachar. After Abimelech, there arose to save Israel Tola, the son of Puah, son of Dodo, a man of Issachar. And he lived at Shamir in the hill country of Ephraim. And Issachar was also one of the few tribes that came out with Deborah to fight the Canaanites. We read in Judges chapter 5. The princes of Issachar came with Deborah, and Issachar faithful to Barak. Into the valley they rushed at his heels. So faithfulness and service came to characterize the tribe of Issachar. So it's no surprise that 200 chiefs of clans in the tribe of Issachar reported for duty at Hebron to serve David. Yes, David, there is recompense for your labors in the faithful service of the tribe of Issachar. In fact, Chronicles documents that the tribe of Issachar fielded 87,000 mighty warriors, as the text says, enrolled by genealogy. And this was more than any other single tribe in Israel. And they were distinguished by a very valuable attribute. That is, men who had understanding of the times. Crucial to know exactly what they mean here by this. The idea of understanding. The Hebrew word, yadach, is ubiquitous for having a thorough knowledge of a thing, used widely throughout the Hebrew Old Testament. Having a thorough knowledge of a thing. In Job 28:23, for example, God understands the way to wisdom. That's our word used here too, yadach. God understands the way to wisdom and he knows its place. Or David says in Psalm 119:152, long have I known from your testimonies, our word again, yadach, knowing thoroughly and completely. Long have I known from your testimonies that you have founded them forever, David says. So, a thorough acquaintance with a subject is indicated here, too. And it is of the times. Yat is the Hebrew word there. And the Hebrew is equivalent to how we use times in this context, almost identical. That is, a defined period of time characterized by specified events. A defined period of time characterized by specified events. This word yat occurs throughout the Old Testament as well. For example, Jeremiah 51, Jeremiah tells Israel, for thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, the daughter of Babylon is like a threshing floor at the time when it is trodden. Yat used there. Yet a little while, and the time of her harvest will come. Yat, a defined period of time characterized by specified events. Or from Numbers 23:23. There is no enchantment against Jacob, that beautiful poem of Israel, forecasting indeed the deliverer. There is no enchantment against Jacob, no divination against Israel. At this time, it shall be said of Jacob and Israel, what has God wrought? At this time. Once again, a specified period of time characterized by specified events. The sense here is that one knows the circumstances, players, background, significance of what's transpiring before their eyes. They can weigh the various factors and forces at play and understand exactly what is going on. Redemptive history is unfolding before them, and they are on it, Issachar. They don't have half-baked opinions on what's going on based upon inaccurate or partial information. They're not lazy or indifferent to the times, content to live in a comfortable cultural cocoon, placidly letting the world go by, reciting platitudes like, the Lord's in control after all, right? And their view is not distorted by their prejudices and biases and hatreds, so that their understanding of the times is clouded. Our Lord rebukes the Pharisees for not knowing how to interpret their times in exactly this fashion. He tells them, you hypocrites, you know how to interpret the appearance of earth and sky, but why do you not know how to interpret the present time? The men of Issachar were not Pharisees. The men of Issachar were not progressives with distorted worldviews that twisted their understanding of the times. The men of Issachar were not naive evangelicals, indifferent to the times because the rapture was coming soon, or because this world is not our home and we shouldn't trouble ourselves. The men of Issachar had a clear eye and a sober mind. They could see that David was the true shepherd of Israel. They could see that God had rejected Saul for his unfaithfulness. They could see that God was supernaturally blessing and keeping David, despite all of Saul's efforts to kill him. Issachar, in distinction from the rest of Israel, had an understanding of the times. Have things changed? Is anything more required of us than to sit and wait for the rapture or ignore in favor of eternity? I would submit to you that today, as it always has been in redemptive history, that the church and the country need men who understand the times as much as David needed men like those of Issachar. It's been like this throughout the history of the church. Many in America need to get over their reticence at getting their hands dirty in applying the gospel to the times in which we live. One of my favorite examples from history is the great deacon and scholar of the medieval church, Alcuin. We studied him briefly in church history, in our church history course. He became advisor and confidant to the Holy Roman Emperor Charlemagne in the late 8th, early 9th century. The Englishman Alcuin had earned a reputation as a scholar and a developer of the great library at York. There was a mini renaissance during this period. It's still called a renaissance during this period. Charlemagne eagerly sought advice from all over his empire as to how to most effectively rule as a Christian prince. Now, not everybody's aware of this either. Charlemagne is worth studying as a Christian prince because he eagerly wanted to know, how can I rule as a Christian prince from the Bible? And Alcuin, a close student of the times, was more than eager and ready to oblige Charlemagne. One historian puts it this way: Charlemagne saw a trusted advisor in Alcuin, and besides his teachings, he also had a vast influence on political issues. Even though he grew up at the monastic school at York, he was not a monk, and he was always concerned with worldly matters just as much as he was with religious ones. He combined both, and he played a huge role in forming and bringing forward the idea of ideal rulership. Charlemagne wanted to know. Alcuin educated him. On the one hand, as a ruler with certain attributes, and on the other, as a preacher who spreads Christianity. The emperor should be such. In Alcuin's eyes, a king should guide and rule his realm, ensure justice, renew the church, and unify the people under his rule. Being the person who decides in a just way, defends against oppression, makes laws, takes care of strangers and pilgrims, and spread the word of Christ everywhere, which is precisely what Charlemagne endeavored to do. In our own day, we require those who understand the times in which we live, like Alcuin. Are we ready to abandon all of God's good creation and all of this life under the sun to the world and the devil because we're only pilgrims here and have no lasting home? Our world, and the United States of America in particular, stands at a crossroads in history. We have opportunity to staunch the flow of blood in America from the evils of abortion and war, for example. We have the opportunity to end modern slavery that comes from human trafficking of women and children across the border, and rather bring liberty to the people. We have the opportunity to end the worldwide tyranny that sucks the wealth from the average working man and funnels it to the wealthy lords of the earth. We have the opportunity to spread the gospel across the world and in our own country by standing tall in the public square for the First Amendment. But it does require men who know the times. and then does something about it. That brings us to point two. Tuned in. As of the men of Issachar and Israel, so the church needs men today who, in consequence of understanding, know what to do. Second part of verse 32. It's one thing to have a command of the facts on the ground. It's another thing to then proceed to action. Issachar knew and presumably led Israel in anointing David as king and helped him subdue the rest of Israel under him. David says it well in Psalm 144, "Blessed be the Lord my rock, who trains my hands for war and my fingers for battle. He is my steadfast love and my fortress, my stronghold and my deliverer, my shield, and he in whom I trust, who subdues my people under me." It's not always a simple thing to act upon the knowledge that one has. Historically, for example, Stalin knew for months in 1942 that Germany was building up its forces on the border with Ukraine for an invasion. Funny how Ukraine enters into so many wars, right? But Stalin did not act on it, believing that the Molotov-Ribbentrop non-aggression pact would be honored. Not until Hitler launched Operation Barbarossa did Stalin realize his failure to act on what he knew. Today, Americans have known for years that the flood of unchecked, unvetted illegal immigrants would bring in criminals and gangs and military-aged males into the country with disastrous effects. Now, for example, Venezuelan gangs like Tren de Aragua are terrorizing Americans with drugs and human trafficking and extortion, even taking over apartment buildings across the country. We're beginning to understand our failure to act on what we know any sooner than we have. And if you do not act upon what you know is right, James tells us, "So whoever knows the right thing to do and fails to do it, for him it is sin." But Issachar knew the time to anoint David king. They knew that it was propitious, and with others, as verse 40 tells us, came bringing food on donkeys and on camels and on mules and oxen, abundant provisions of flour, cakes of figs, clusters of raisins, and wine and oil, oxen and sheep, for there was joy in Israel. Well, we have reached a similar crossroads in our own day. Do we have such godly men as old Israel? Men who have understanding of the times, to know what the church and the country ought to do. One of my favorite examples is J. Gresham Machen, who helped found our own Orthodox Presbyterian Church. But he was also asked to help in a larger cultural venture, a cultural and a church issue that faced the church in the modernist fundamentalist controversy that was raging at the time in the country. The Presbyterian Church in the United States, a committee of that church, had delineated five fundamental doctrines without whose affirmation no minister should be ordained. Those five: number one, the inspiration and inerrancy of the Bible. Number two, the virgin birth of Christ. Number three, the substitutionary atonement of Christ's death. Number four, the bodily resurrection of Christ. And number five, the historical reality of Christ's miracles. There were ministers who denied these five essential doctrines and still expected to be ordained. Well, in the midst of this controversy, a wealthy Presbyterian layman, Lyman Stewart, asked a number of conservative scholars to publish works that defended each of these fundamentals. It was meant for distribution to the wider American public. Machen was asked to treat of the virgin birth. And ergo, we have his masterful book, The Virgin Birth. Still, really, the measure of defense of, from both Bible and reason, of the virgin birth. That's an excellent volume, still worth reading and picking up today. Machen was a man of Issachar in this sense. No one understood the times better than him. His book on liberalism, modern liberalism, is being renewed and put back on the market, republished, because indeed he was a man of Issachar in this sense. He understood the times, and so he acted, knowing what the Presbyterian Church and America should do. We would not have the OPC if not for men like him. But unfortunately, one of the legacies of this controversy is that the evangelical wing of the church got beaten so badly and humiliated so thoroughly that she went into retreat and really has never fully recovered from that retreat. Pay close attention, because there's still a hangover from this period. Exhibit A is the Scopes trial. So badly did William Jennings Bryan and conservative Christians come off in that trial that it's come to be known as the Scopes Monkey Trial. The Scopes Monkey Trial, with Jennings Bryan as the monkey. In Dayton, Tennessee, in 1925, John Scopes was a high school teacher charged with the then illegal act of teaching evolution in his classes. It was hyped and amplified in the press all over the country, and that little courtroom in Dayton, I had a chance to visit there once and spend an afternoon in that region, and that little courtroom in Dayton became a media circus. The media called it the trial of the century. Great deal of drama. All of America's eyes were on it at the time. The then famous William Jennings Bryan, America's evangelical and the eloquent spokesman for Christianity, came to be the star witness for the prosecution and defend the biblical view against evolution. But Bryan and the conservatives were really outflanked by the evolutionists, led by defense attorney Clarence Darrow. For days, the evidence for Darwin's theory of evolution was meticulously laid out, and many Americans heard it for the first time. And Darrow cleverly attempted to make it sound as rational and scientific as possible. Now, Bryan was admittedly unprepared. He later admitted this. He arrogantly assumed that his position was the correct one and that all he had to do was cite a few Bible verses and the case would be made. But a very clever Clarence Darrow utterly humiliated Bryan on the stand when Bryan could not give a reasoned scientific understanding of the biblical view. That's why it's called the monkey trial, with Bryan as the monkey. It is often said that conservatives won the battle because Scopes was convicted, but they lost the war over evolution. America at the time was fascinated and obsessed with all things science, and Darrow had done a masterful job of making Darwin's theory of evolution sound scientific. Conversely, William Jennings Bryan had come off as an ignorant buffoon who was a Bible thumper and nothing more. Bryan was never the same. In fact, he died 2 weeks after the conclusion of the trial, and many say it was that that finally did him in. And in a larger sense, evangelicalism in America died a kind of public death too. Conservatives retreated from the public square. They abandoned politics and culture just as evolution and secularism came on with a vengeance. Now, many factors contributed to that retreat, that banishment, if you will, to the cultural wilderness, but the Scopes trial was our Waterloo. Now, over the decades, the church in America has scratched and clawed its way back to its calling to impact the larger culture with the gospel, to be men of Issachar, as well as saving souls and anticipating Christ's return. But that John the Baptist in the wilderness mentality has never quite gone away. It's a cultural thing. Don't mistake this. And so many American evangelicals still embrace it. One of my favorite old-time preachers, some of you gray hairs may remember him, J. Vernon McGee. I used to listen to him on the radio when I was a young Christian, and he's just a folksy kind of preacher from the South, and loved to listen to him. But he used to say, we must not soil the garments of the gospel with politics and culture, right? So nobody expresses this view of retreat and church in the wilderness kind of thing, as did this phrase, at least for me, of J. Vernon McGee. We must not soil the garments of the gospel with politics and culture. The gospel's too good for that. But I've come to see that that sentiment is misguided. It's far too cynical and limiting of the power of the gospel to hold for long. When the gospel transforms, it transforms everything, including politics and culture, when practiced by serious believing Christians. That's been the case for 2,000 years now. The church has always taught this and practiced it. And the world is a far different, even if you've been with us in our church history class, you know that the world is a far different and better place than it would have been without it. The men of Issachar would not be in retreat. They would not be retiring to a cultural cocoon. They would be understanding our times and knowing what the church and nation ought to do. Pray for this in the course of this year. We stand at a crossroads in not only our country, but our world. And we need the men of Issachar, our own brand of them, our own form of them here under the new covenant, to be understanding our times and knowing what the church and nation ought to do. Well, with that in mind, let us now come to that place where we witness before all the world as well. We do this every week. We witness before the world the power of redemption that transforms everything around us. That is the sacrifice of Christ in his body and blood, in the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.